From PowerlineBlog.com and produced by Ricochet.com, this is The Powerline Show with your host, Steve Hayward.
In a just world, Phil Magnus would have an endowed chair at Harvard or Yale or the University of Chicago or someplace like that. But we don't live in that just world for reasons that everyone knows. On the other hand, by not being in one of those traditional academic jobs, Phil doesn't have to spend a lot of his time in faculty meetings, on committees, grading papers and teaching classes, and that may help explain his prodigious output from his outpost as the director of research at the American Institute of Economic Research in Massachusetts. AIER, by the way, are the people who brought you the great Barrington Declaration about COVID, which has been fully vindicated despite the best attempts of Anthony Fauci and the rest to demonize it and suppress, actually, and censor the authors of that document. Now, Phil is one of my favorite persons to follow on social media because he drives a lot of people on the left absolutely out of their mind. And in particular, he is, I think, more responsible than anyone for disturbing the reveries of Nicole Hannah-Jones and the other champions of the 1619 Project with his meticulous work showing their errors of fact and interpretation. I want to talk to him about his most recent article in the Journal of Political Economy, one of the premier journals of the field, along with his co-author Michael McCauvey, called The Mainstreaming of Marx. And what's interesting about this article is that Phil and his co-author Michael discovered that Marx was a very marginal figure through much of his life and in the late 19th and early 20th century, and it was only the Russian Revolution that revived Marx and propelled him into the fame as an intellectual leader of the left that we all have known ever since. Now, for some reason, this was greeted with outrage by people on the left and even a few on the right, and therein lies a tale. In addition to walking through this subject, we talk a little bit about neoliberalism, which is another puzzling phenomenon that began chiefly on the left, but is also finding some followers today on the right, and that makes for a very head-spinning experience right now. And then finally, we check in briefly with what the latest is on the 1619 Project, which simply won't go away, despite its obvious flaws and bad faith. And so with that, let's turn to Phil and have some fun. Well, Phil, it's great to catch up with you. You are my favorite person to follow on social media because I don't know how you do it, and it's my frequent joke that we need some robust rent control because you're occupying so much space for free in the heads of a lot of people on the left, but a few on the right too. But let's start with this recent article of yours that I know has been a long time in the making, just out in the Journal of Political Economy. And it's an interesting proposition, which I'll summarize it this way, and then you can correct me. It's that Karl Marx and Marxism was largely unknown by the end of the 19th and early 20th century, and only came to prominence because of the Russian Revolution, which means it was kind of a contingent thing that this guy emerged as the great, thinker of the left. And that seems perfectly sensible to me, but it's really upset a lot of people. So anyway, why don't you go through what you found, how you did it, and what listeners should know about the article.
Yeah, absolutely. So when we see Karl Marx today, we think of him as one of these giant figures of the intellectual canon, and that's certainly how he's taught in universities. He's, depending on what metric you use, usually in the top 2 to 3 most assigned authors in the philosophical canon. He's all over the English department, the sociology department, history, philosophy. All of these major disciplines teach Marx as a significant, important thinker, quite possibly one of the most important thinkers of the last two centuries. So very, very high levels of academic prestige and acclaim and attention that's paid to him. Yet if you go back around a century ago, you go back a little more than a century ago, so the turn of the 20th century, and Marx is a relatively obscure figure. Don't just take my word for that. You can see that attested to on the political left. W.E.B. Du Bois writes that in his memoirs, that Marx was almost never taught in the U.S. universities when he went through college in the 1890s. You have prominent Marxists themselves, like the Marxist historian Eric Hobsbawm, studies the number of copies of Marx's books that were put into print in the 19th century, and he finds it's only a couple thousand copies. So he's not this huge intellectual giant of his age. And I'd always been kind of curious in this question and thought of a way to look into it, to see the pattern of dissemination of Marx's works by tracking his citations over time. And very recently, we've got to the point where, we call it big data. There are massive databases out there that now scan millions, if not tens of millions of pages of books. The most famous one that almost everyone's familiar with is Google Books, and that's the corpus that we're building around. What they've done is they've scanned like entire university libraries of books going back to the 1500s, various estimates depending on what set you use and what language. They now estimate that Google has somewhere between 10 to 20% of all books ever written have been scanned in some form or another into their library. So it's just a massive database. And when they did so, they used text recognition software to create this thing. They call it, it's Google Ngram. So many of you have probably used the Google Ngram viewer. It's a fun little tool. You can see, you pull it up and it'll say, when did Albert Einstein, he's the one that they use as their standard time, when did he start appearing in the scientific journals and become a famous figure? And Ngram measures the number of times a name or a word or a phrase is used as a relative percentage of all books that were in print that they've scanned for that year. So you can see the levels change over time. I thought this is a really neat tool. And what I knew about Karl Marx is in his own lifetime, there are really only two groups of people that pay attention to him. One of them is fellow socialists on the radical fringe periphery of the political spectrum. We're talking very, very small groups of radical revolutionary activists. And in particular, it's fellow Marxists, but it's, you can fit them in a telephone booth in that era. And then the second group that starts to pay attention to him, this is a couple of years after he dies, is professional economists. They start to notice his theories. But what they immediately do, and really the first major economist to take on Karl Marx, is a guy named Philip Wicksteed. He publishes a pretty devastating critique of him in over the course of about five pages. These were economists after the event that we refer to as the Marginal Revolution, where they figured out a solution to the problem of value. Value is subjective based on decisions made on the margin on the moment of the choice or the exchange, not the labor theory of value, which is what Karl Marx built his entire system on. So from about the mid-1880s onward, economists read Das Kapital and all these other books that have been written by Marx. They track them down because they're pretty obscure in that era. They read them and they thoroughly reject them. They say this is an obsolete theory. And I'm not just saying people on the right. John Maynard Keynes in 1922 or thereabouts writes an essay and says, Karl Marx's Capital is an obsolete textbook of no interest to the modern world. And rendered obsolete. Keynes, I mean, the giant of the economic left, is saying this about Marx's textbook. So that's really interesting. And you find multiple indicators from the late 19th, early 20th century that every time economists consider Marx, they think, well, yeah, this is kind of crankery. This is already 40 years out of date. The theory doesn't really work. They find internal contradictions. They find it cannot be mathematically acted upon. So central planning is basically disproved on a mathematical level as well. And then by, about the 1910s, every economist that considers it, they view it as like a curiosum of history. That there was this guy that wrote a really radical socialistic theory of labor economics, but nothing of it holds together. And that's where things stood in about 1916.
Yeah, I think it was certain things come back to me now because I gave up on Marx 30 years ago when I thought Marxism was over after the Cold War ended, and now it's all come back in new and different forms.
That's exactly it.
I think it was the British, left-wing British figure R.H. Tawney who said once, Marx was the last of the schoolmen, meaning the scholastics of the Thomas Aquinas era. And I guess the same reason, right? I mean, no modern economist, I think, thinks that the medieval theory of the just price is something that could be calculated holds any sense, right?
That's exactly it.
And so here was Marx kind of reviving that in a new Hegelian basis, I guess you might say. So what Lenin comes along? Is it almost that simple?
So found a really interesting pattern. I'm looking at the Ngram data that comes out of the Google book scans, and you see Marx's name. It's just kind of piddling along there for a couple of decades after his death, not really growing in very substantial ways. It fluctuates year to year, and maybe it that coincides when a new translation came out and things like that. But he's a pretty minor figure, relatively speaking, in that period. And then in 1917, it just skyrockets. Mm. References, citations, mentions of Marx in other books just take off. It's like overnight it triples, and then it goes off to the races from there. So we track it out for about a decade after 1917, and you just see this clear upward trend. So I think that's really interesting that Marx is suddenly this figure that everyone's talking about, and he starts to surpass other prominent figures in his age. Mm. So when Marx is writing, and in the decades after his death, a fairly obscure economist today, but who was much better known in that era, is Henry George.
Oh, right.
He's an American thinker. Sure. We don't teach Georgist economics except in very specialized programs today. Right. But in the late 19th century, he's a prominent figure, and he's cited at significantly higher rates than Karl Marx. Well, Marx passes George like shortly after 1917. Then he starts getting up into like Adam Smith territory and some of the more famous names that we do recognize. So what happens is we've got this theory that Lenin, through the Bolshevik Revolution, which is premised on disseminating Marx and acting out Marxist theory, really puts him onto the mainstream intellectual map, and has been off to the races ever since. So our big test is we built this database out of data we mined out of Google Ngram for 226 other authors out of the intellectual canon, people that were either contemporaries of Marx or going all the way back to the ancient world, so Aristotle and Plato and stuff like that. And we calculated all of their citations year by year, and we fit them into a model, a computerized algorithm. Mm. It's a really sophisticated supercomputer type analysis. It's called a synthetic control model. And what it basically does is it algorithmically fits all of these other authors, it takes composites of their citations, it tries to find the other ones that track Karl Marx between his death and 1916. And it gets a very precise fit line to that. It's a composite of several other figures that were his contemporaries, weighted, done algorithmically by the computer. The computer assigns the weight, so it takes some of the biases out of that. And what you can do is, if you can create a strong fit line prior to 1917, you can project forward to what Marx's citation pattern would have looked like had Lenin died on his way to St. Petersburg, or had he never staged the revolution. And we find this, and you know, the two patterns are, one is the real Marx is shooting off to the sky. It's like a rocket ship. And then the regular, this counterfactual synthetic Marx, it just continues along it. This slow, steady, low citation, relatively niche, kind of obscure figure pace. And you look at the composites of it, and synthetic Marx, the counterfactual Marx, it's actually composed of his other 19th century socialist competitors.
Mm, yeah.
His contemporaries. It's Ferdinand LaSalle, Johann Karl Rodbertus. And, you know, I mentioned these names. Your viewers, right. Unless they're really into the history of economic thought, they've probably never heard of these guys.
Well, yeah, I mean, right. He'd rank down there with Feuerbach.
Exactly that type of thing. There are specialists that study them today, but they're not the single most assigned textbook in university courses.
Right. Well, now the odd thing to me is, so this is a straightforward quantitative exercise. It's a lay person can, I mean, what you just said about your algorithm may lose a few people, but the conclusion is pretty straightforward and easy to grasp. And what's amazing to me is that a lot of your, I won't even call them critics because they don't even engage the argument, but a lot of people on the left are losing their minds over your argument. And I have a theory as to why, which I'll share with you, but why would they be upset at this? Who cares if Lenin gave the boost to Marx? What's behind this outrage?
Right. Well, like a friend joked to me, this would be akin to a free market economist being upset that the inflationary crisis of the 1970s boosted Milton Friedman's citation.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Like, I hear that. I say, yep, that kind of makes sense. It made Friedman very prominent because he's one of the critics of inflation. The reaction was like this visceral gut rage that burst out on, you know, of all places, it's on the Twitter sphere. They see the paper, they kind of read the abstract, they object to the conclusion, don't bother to really investigate the paper, and then we just get this venomous, often profane assault coming from these journalist Twitter types on the center left, and then or to the far left in many cases. Yeah, and they're just raging in fury at our results. It's like, well, how dare they suggest that the great Karl Marx was fairly obscure prior to 1917. And, right. You know, we never claim that nobody cited Marx prior to 1917. In fact, in the paper, we trace all these economists that refute him, but he's a niche subject. And we also trace these competitors that engage with him. So Rodbertus, who's a composite donor to the counterfactual, not only was he like a contemporary, but his followers viciously feuded with the other Marxists for who got to be the dominant socialist. And Robertus's followers accused Marx of plagiarizing the theory of surplus value from them. So they hate each other, but they're contemporaries at roughly the same segment of society that they're competing for the attention for. So we never claim that Marx was completely unknown. We just say he's relatively obscure. And they're furious about this. And I think one of the reasons here is it gets into some of the psyche of the post-1991 Marxist revival that we've seen going on in the academy through today.
Yeah, okay.
So what happened in 1991, that was really like the nail in the coffin that discredited Soviet state Marxism. Discredited the whole Leninist, Stalin, Bolshevik experiment. Of course, the hundreds of millions of bodies that stacked up in its wake didn't help that either. But it was a final note in a really bad chapter of human history. But the Marxists today, if you ask them, they'll say, well, Lenin and Stalin were not true Marxists. You hear that one all
right.
The time.
It's never really been tried.
And
right.
They said Pol Pot was not a true Marxist. Castro was not a true Marxist. Mao was not a true Marxist. So every time a Marxist seizes power and commits mass atrocities, they say, well, it's not true Marxism. Yeah. And I think what you have among intellectual leftists today, these are the people that were outraged at the paper. So it's a subset of Marxists today, but probably the ones that are most associated with the academy and journalism. They are furious because one of the implications of our paper is if Lenin is what puts Marx on the map, Lenin is now necessarily a part of their own intellectual heritage, and they don't baggage. Right. Now, there's another subset of the Marxists, so it was a really curious reaction. We had like 50% of Marxists and leftists that saw our paper were furious, and how dare you insinuate that Marx got his fame from Lenin? This is an outrage. We actually adhere to the pre-Leninist Marx, which is the true Karl Marx. But then there's the other 50%, which I guess are the kind of the old school Soviet Marxists, and they're like, why is this paper even published? This is uncontroversial. We've known this for decades.
Yeah. Well, you know, my theory is I have a twofold theory, which you as a more quantitatively oriented person than me may or may not think is right or full. It's that for the left, the two parts of this, I think a lot of leftist academics are deeply intellectually insecure people. I can say more about that going forward.
Sure.
But that connects to the bigger problem, point number two, which is, what was that? Was it one of those French thinkers 40 years ago had the book whose title I think translated was From Marx to Jesus or Jesus to Marx? For the modern, I don't remember, maybe I read it, I don't remember it now, but just the title vaguely in my head, you know, Marx was the gospel. I mean, literally the gospel for, you know, for lack of a better term, the secular left. And to now say that his prominence is owing to complete historical accident and contingency, with someone with a dubious legacy, as you just point out, I think is shattering to them.
Yes.
So, I mean, that's my theory. But then I want to work the other side of the street, which is when you first started, as I recall, rolling out drafts of the paper and talking about this, I think you attracted some fire from the right, from some libertarians. Yeah. And I'm like, what? So walk through that a little bit. And is the theory there that some people on the right need a villain? And if you downgrade Marx from the pedestal the left puts him on, it also deprives us of a villain? I mean, that seems stupid to me, but I'm trying to figure out why anyone on our team would object to what you're finding.
Yes, I think there's two groups there. One is exactly that. There are people that think, well, Marx was the great villain of the 20th century, therefore he must have been a big deal.
Yeah.
So saying that this is an accident of history just really kind of takes the intellectual heft out of the adversary in ways that they kind of feel like, hey, we've been wasting our time spinning our wheels. There's also a subset of the libertarian movement that, and this goes back to some 19th century traditions, although they don't align with Marx himself, they view Marx as partially right, as like having diagnosed the inequities of society and the injustices. And because they see him as like an offshoot of the tradition that went in the wrong direction, That also means to them that their forebearers are had it wrong to diagnose the excesses of the 19th century industrialization processes as something that was liberating or libertarian oriented. So you had elements of both of those. They saw the paper and they were upset as well.
Yeah, I just found that bizarre. Let's take a brief break right here to hear from our sponsors, and then we'll be back with topic number two. Don't go away. Let's move on to a related subject, which also has the strange left-right incoherence to it, and that is the great term thrown around ubiquitously today, neoliberalism.
Neoliberal.
Yeah, so, you know, neoliberalism is, I think maybe I saw one of your engrams about this. I think some other people have done this too, showing that it's a term that exploded into use starting in the mid to late 1990s.
Exactly.
It first comes to sight as an epithet by the left who don't like, and what they mean by neoliberalism is Reagan and Thatcher, Milton Friedman, Friedrich Hayek, von Mises, you know, our political and intellectual heroes, I think.
Yeah.
And it is, you know, it's definitely to call someone a neoliberal is like for a conservative calling someone a Marxist or a socialist, right? So anyway, I walk through a little bit of the history of this because I know there's an earlier part to all this. And then I also want to get to the way it's emerging and being embraced by the right lately, which is the second question. Give me your sort of quick summary history of, you know, where the term emerged, where did this come from, something like that.
Yeah. Yeah, so I've got an article digging into the deep history, the etymology of the term, where it burst into the scene. As you noted, you can see this in Google Ngram again, so I love playing around with this data. It's really not until like the mid-1990s that this term that almost nobody had ever used before suddenly becomes the thing. It's the standard insult for everyone on the left to refer to anyone in the free market tradition. And it turns out if you dig a little bit deeper into that, there's a very specific reason. And the reason is that's when the French philosopher Michel Foucault, his lectures, which were recorded in the late 1970s, some of his like classroom college lectures, they were translated and started to appear in print. And in 1979, he gave a series of lectures on what he called the subject of neoliberalism.
Hmm.
And this is, you know, it's an interesting read, complex take on the subject, not quite the dumbed down version that you see today, but this is what gets everyone interested in it, and it takes off in the 1990s. It's clearly an aftermath of Foucault being translated, and people liking Foucault for other reasons, they find this, and aha, he's onto something. But the lectures themselves are about a much earlier event. It's a conference that occurs in Paris in 1938, called the Walter Lippmann Colloquium. And what Foucault had done, and he had been digging through some archives, he finds the transcripts of this conference and Mises and Hayek and all these other major figures of the interwar era free market scene were at this conference. And during the course of the conference, they bantered about what should we call ourselves as a movement. I think they sort of end up on what we refer to as classical liberals today, but someone raised the point, said, well, maybe we should call ourselves neoliberals. And they talk about it, they debate it, and the conference ultimately rejects it. So in 1938, they talk the term neoliberal, but they reject it. And I'm reading this and I start digging. I said, well, why did they reject this term? Well, it turns out it has an earlier history. So the conference proceedings have been printed in English, and I think some of the original were in French, but they involved a lot of thinkers like Hayek and Mises that are native German speakers and come out of Vienna, Austria as their training. So I start looking in some of the older sources and ask the question, did neoliberalism have a prehistory in German language? And it turns out it does. I go back to the 1920s and start researching some of the debates over free market and marginalist thought. And you find out something really interesting. The first is that a group of Marxists in Austria started using the term neoliberal to specifically refer to Mises as this term of pejorative derision. And they said he's a neoliberal as distinct from a classical liberal. And the gist of their argument was that Mises had tried to revive the old liberal economic doctrines from the successful assault that Marxism had made on it that was then ascendant because of Vladimir Lenin. So bring this kind of full circle. They're saying, classical liberalism predates Marx. Marx successfully proved it was wrong. And here's this Mises guy that's trying to resuscitate it and bring life back into it. So he's now the neoliberal figure. Neoliberalism is one of the permutations of the term. And there are even articles that appear in the Marxist newsletters that say Ludwig von Mises, neoliberal.
Yeah.
Just using this as an insult. So this is in the early 1920s, and almost simultaneously, Mises has this rival on the faculty at the University of Vienna, University of Vienna, where he teaches, that comes from the far right. It's a fellow by the name of Otmar Spahn.
Oh, I've never even heard of him. I've heard of most of these people, but not him.
Yeah, Otmar Spahn, and they're like legendary rivals on the faculty, the guys that would get up and shout at each other in faculty meetings because they hated each other. Otmar Spahn's interesting because in several of Mises' later books, he starts referring to him as the Nazi philosopher, Otmar Spahn. So Spahn wrote one of the most popular German language economics textbooks in that era. It was published in like something like 20 different editions. Mm. And the edition that came out in 1924, it's right as this insult's being used, he adds a new chapter on the neoliberal school. The neoliberal school, and it's talking about his rival in the department, Mises, and talking about some other departments that were aligned with that, with the free market thought. So it's this really critical assessment, and he popularizes the term because this is one of the most commonly used textbooks. So what it comes down to is the pejorative originated in the 1920s as a mutual term of disparagement by the Marxist far left and the proto-Nazi, proto-fascist right. Market guys in the middle.
Yeah, so no wonder Lippmann and von Mises and Hayek would not have wanted to embrace that term for themselves in the late 1930s. By the way, you probably know this. I don't remember which history of the Mont Pelerin Society I read this in, but there was a whole account of that 1938 meeting. It was either Angus Bergen's book or the Stedman-Jones book. Right. I read them both, and they talked about how that was going to be that became ultimately the Mont Pelerin Society.
After the war, a lot of people returned after the war, and
right. But the war got in the way, but they were getting together in the late 30s because look, all around them, they saw either New Dealism, mild socialism, or hard socialism advancing everywhere. Okay, interesting intellectual history there. All right, so. The term was revived. Oh, one quick side question here since you've read it. I've heard about those Foucault lectures. I've never looked them up myself. I have heard it said or claimed now and then that he was expressing in his late years before he died in 83 or 84, he was expressing some sympathy or interest in agreement with.
That is indeed correct.
Libertarianism. Is that actually in there?
Like Foucault started as a Marxist, straight out of the mid 20th century Marxist tradition. And he starts to have some qualms with that. And there's one of his observations that he makes is, it's like, why does every society that claims to be built on Marxist principles end in genocide?
Yeah.
And he says, we need to be asking that question. Is there something about Marxist ideas that always veer down this same path of mass atrocity?
Interesting. Put a pin in this for now, and we want to talk about this again someday down the road. But there are a few people like my political philosopher friend, Glenn Elmers, who are starting to say, we shouldn't be so hasty in rejecting Foucault in total, partly for this particular aspect, but partly for a couple of others. And we'll leave that aside for now. I'm just curious, since you actually read through this. All right, let's. So we know how the left is using it. It's ridiculous. But in the last 2-3 years, I've noticed that a number of people on the right, serious people, some friends of mine, are starting to use the term neoliberal in almost exactly the same sense as the leftists do, which is now it's one thing if you don't like Swedish style corporatism or what might be called state capitalism and the rent seeking it's a lot of what they are calling neoliberal economics is the kind of things the public choice theory has been after for a long time. But I don't know, this also bothers me a bit. It seems to me that I'm not quite sure where I even go to a question on this, but what do you make of the fact that so many people on our side of the spectrum are suddenly using the term the same way the left has used it? This worries me.
Yeah, it's a new trend on the political right. The mid 20th century to the present or very recent political coalition had always been kind of the free market libertarian economics had united with the anti-communist strain of American conservatism. The famous version of it was Frank Myers fusionism.
Right.
William F. Buckley built the philosophy around it. It's free markets and a free society of American values. That used to be the coalition of the broader political right. And what we've seen in the last couple of years is portions of the political right are starting to jettison the free market component, the economic component, the libertarian component. And they even, some subset of them, they make the argument that economic classical liberalism led the right astray, and we need to replace it with a more robust industrial policy, tariffs, trade protectionism,
right.
All of these packages of economic intervention that are supposed to bolster up American towns and the Rust Belt and in society. And their claim is that it's the free market economists that cause the political right to be weaker at the polls and to lose elections, and that they want to jettison that as kind of a move to outflank the economic interventionist left. And they'll say, well, we need an alternative industrial policy that stops Bernie Sanders by we'll capture the issue. So a lot of that's burst onto the scene. And in the wake of that, they've also started to attack free market economists by using the same terminology that the Marxist left does. So what you've seen, and this has been really pronounced, I see even just the last few months, you can Google it and you can see in conservative leaning publications, they start ranting and raving about the neoliberals.
Yeah.
How we need to jettison the neoliberals from the movement. And you start reading this and it is almost word for word like a Marxist conspiracy tract.
Yeah, I mean, you even see that phrase used in some articles in National Review, which I think would make William F. Buckley roll over in his grave. I mean, I'm
Absolutely.
So old, I like to joke. I'm now so old, I get to begin a lot of sentences with, I'm so old, I remember. And in 1984, Walter Mondale ran for president on a platform of industrial policy. And
exactly.
It was unanimous on the right that this was just socialism. This is just
yep.
a euphemism for socialism. And so now I'm asking some of my friends saying, so, you know, Mondale just died a year or two ago. Sweet man, personally. Can he be the Republican nominee for president now? Because I don't see a lot of details on this. It's one thing to say, it's one thing to observe that, yeah, we've hollowed out the Rust Belt and become uncompetitive. I think free trade is an insufficient, it's an aspect of the story, but it's not the whole story. And therefore, the remedies are very vague. It's just, we need industrial policy. All right, tell me in detail, what's that going to mean? Subsidies, tax breaks, trade barriers? It's very frustrating because it worries me when we give, even if indirectly and unintentionally, if we give a succor and aid to the radical left. So I don't know if you have anything to add to that or not.
Exactly. I mean, it's I liken it to the old Lord of the Rings problem with the Ring of Power,
yeah.
where you have famously Boromir of Gondor says, well, why don't we use the ring to our own advantage? And I see some elements of the right say, well, the socialists want all these things. Well, why don't we co-opt it and use the same thing and we'll win elections and then we can defeat them? And they don't realize that they're basically putting us on the same path to economic intervention and destruction.
Yeah, I'm not sure it's a vote winner either. I mean, it wasn't for Mondale.
No, it
he lost 49
absolutely,
states.
Absolutely so, wasn't.
Okay, let's take another quick break here to hear from a sponsor, and then we'll be back to talk about the 1619 Project. A third item here. You have been an absolute demon on the 1619 Project from the
yes.
first moment the ink dried at the New York Times, and this is one of those jobs that I'm glad you're doing it so I don't have to, but Nicole Hannah-Jones, you drive her nuts on Twitter, which is fun, even though she's blocked you, I think, right? But she'll
right,
still,
right. She still goes in there every couple of months or so and
right.
rant about how horrible I am because of
right. yeah,
her
okay.
errors in her project.
Again, living rent-free and congratulations on all that. But you have been watching what? She's got a documentary going on one of the streaming services,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah,
and
so
I think one of the networks
out on
is
Hulu, and then they aired it earlier this week on ABC.
Is that it? Yeah, God.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I don't know. We could go on a long time about all this, and we don't want to go on a long time about it. But what are two or three, you know, new things or things you're looking at or especially
yeah.
egregious aspects of the story as it's in play at the moment?
Well, the major one, if you remember all the way back in 2019 when the original version of the project came out, Nicole Hannah-Jones got pilloried in the press for this claim that the American Revolution was premised, at least in large part, as a defensive action of slavery against the British that were supposedly going to come in and free all the slaves or something.
Right.
And that this was a weird claim. It was not very well sourced. If anything, it was based on a bad reading of some very fringe history. And then a couple months after the original came out, the New York Times' own fact checker, who was a historian, kind of broke her silence and says, I warned them not to make this claim and they didn't listen to me.
Yeah.
So it was a bit of a scandal. It was all in the middle of the Pulitzer Prize season. And the New York Times had to real quietly kind of walk back the claim. They made some modifiers. I said, well, only some of the revolutionaries cared about slavery. It really watered it down. But Nicole Hannah Jones has never given that claim up. And yeah. What she's done ever since then is tried to backfill and restore the original assertion by cherry picking bits and pieces of the historical literature. And what you get in this new Hulu series, the one that's showing on ABC this week, broadcast to a national audience, is the very first episode digs in at the beginning and tries to resuscitate this claim. And they go to Colonial Williamsburg in Virginia as their location where they're filming. So they're standing there and among all these historic buildings, and they have the reconstructed Governor's Palace, the colonial British Governor's Palace. If anyone's been there on a tour site, it's like the centerpiece of the whole park. And they're sitting there on the lawn of the palace filming. And one of the claims that she has used to bolster this notion, so the governor of Virginia, the last royalist governor of Virginia, is Lord Dunmore. Right. And he's very famous for getting chased out of Williamsburg, basically. He tries to declare martial law in the colony. There's just a very heavy set of conflicts. And what happened is in November 1775, he issues this proclamation that says, I'm raising a militia to put down the revolt in the colony. And any black person from a rebellious plantation owner who makes his way to my lines and joins my militia, I'll give you your freedom. Hmm. He tries to raise a militia of freed slaves, offering them their freedom. So it's a military tactic. And Nicole Hannah Jones sees this and says, aha, see, Lord Dunmore was going to free the slaves, and this is what drove Virginia to revolt. Of course, this is anachronistic. It turns out that the rebellion had already been underway for the better part of the year. So Lexington and Concord is April 1775. This isn't until November. And what's even
so more, she doesn't even have the chronology straight.
No, she doesn't even have the chronology. And it gets even worse. She's sitting at on the grounds of the governor's palace in Williamsburg and talking to this historian, and they point at the building and say, this is proof from that building there that this edict of emancipation was about to be issued. What she doesn't tell you, Lord Dunmore had been chased out of the colony 5 months earlier by the revolutionary militias and was living on board a ship out in the Atlantic Ocean. He had lost control of his colony, and this is like his last-ditch effort to try to retake Virginia. Not only that, she doesn't tell you that Lord Dunmore himself is a slave owner. So the first thing he does when he gets chased out of Williamsburg, this happens in June 1775, the militias are converging on the city, and they're furious at him, not because of slavery, they're furious at him because he seized the colony's gunpowder stores. This is kind of in it's almost simultaneous to Lexington and Concord. He seizes the gunpowder stores to prevent them from revolting, tries to ship them off in the middle of the night, put them on a British warship, and gets caught. The colonists catch him red-handed, and they're furious, and they start descending on the city to hold him accountable, saying, like, why are you stealing our gunpowder? Well, Dunmore flees in the middle of the night in June 1775. He takes all of his money and all the valuables out of the governor's palace, and he takes all of the slaves from the governor's palace that he owns and moves them to his plantation up the river. And over the next several months, he's sitting there on the ship out in the river, a British warship, and he keeps having his rowboat take him into his plantation house so his slaves can serve him this fancy dinner with all the British officers. So this guy's actually like a really horrible person to make the banner carrier for emancipation. And his whole goal was he wanted to reestablish control over the colony of Virginia so he could return to his massive slave plantation and continue slavery.
Facts are such inconvenient things, Phil, is the problem here. But there's a broader point to this. And also, like neoliberalism and like your work on Marx, there's a curious undercurrent, I'll put it this way, from our team. And so, you know, you've gone on to broaden your critique into critical race theory. And yet there are, I mean, I've seen you made reference to this, and I think I've seen little bits of this. There are certain people on the, I guess, left libertarians, we call them, who Absolutely. Are unhappy with you for, you know, being such a full-throated critique, a critic of the 1619 Project and the critical race theory it's bound to.
Right.
What's happening here? What's tell us about that a little bit.
Well, the gist of it is, you have a segment of the libertarian left and then other people that that view it as impolitic to raise these issues. And there's a couple things going on here. Part of it's because Donald Trump came out against the 1619 Project. Therefore, the Never Trump component, they can't even be associated with anything that he has ever said. So they reject it, even though, you know, I've never been like a big Trump person. I kind of view him as most presidents as a politician.
Right.
A very flawed and problematic politician. But at the same time, you have this segment, and the argument always kind of devolves into this weird, you know, the old Stephen Colbert term, truthiness.
Yes. Yeah.
It is real similar to that. They've decided that even though the 1619 Project is not factually sound, the cause that it's being argued for, which is racial reconciliation and equality, that they want to think, they say that's a just cause. Therefore, we tolerate the errors in service to the cause because the 1619 Project is supposedly on the right side of the social currents of the moment in seeking justice. So it can we can afford to let it slip up on the facts.
You know, I could credit that argument maybe if I thought that there was some chance it would really lead to some reconciliation and racial progress. When in fact, the effect, and I think the intent of a lot of it, is exactly the opposite. It's actually to stoke division. And, you know, we'll see how it'll be interesting to see what our left libertarian friends say if this reparations idea gets some traction and there are actually real proposals put on the table. Because that's when it's all
going to happen. That's exactly where the 1619 Project is going for. Because the other episode that aired earlier this week was the one calling for reparations, a $13 trillion reparations package.
Right. Yeah. My prediction, by the way, is that there's going to be a fight at the Democratic National Committee or convention next summer in their platform, if they have a platform.
Add a reparations blank.
They may not have a platform. I mean, parties are sort of drawing away from because no one really reads them and it's just trouble. But, well, all right. I mean, this is plenty for one day. We could talk a long time deservedly about, you know, income inequality.
Absolutely.
You've got the goods on Piketty and Zuckman and Says and all those guys.
Another episode on that alone.
And, you know, Nancy McLean won't go away. That's important. But let's get out with what's your next big project or what are you working on right now that we should keep our eye on?
Yeah. So I'm continuing to study the citation patterns in Karl Marx because he doesn't just go away after 1917. Lenin's put him on the map and asked the question, well, what happens next? And part of that, you start to see his ideas get picked up to what we now refer to as the Frankfurt School, the Western Marxist tradition.
All right, yeah.
And that's what that leads to things like critical race theory today are outgrowths of that tradition. And you can see similar patterns in their citations picking up in the aftermath of Lenin putting Marx on the map and then some of the political events of the early and mid 20th century. So I've got a major project where I'm digging deep into that to see what the data shows about the way that these figures develop and how do they continue to influence the university today.
Oh, yeah, that'll be a fascinating inquiry because there's so many different nodes to this that, I mean, you know, years ago, you know, I studied how Stalin starting in the 30s caused these great splits on the left and that lead all kinds of different and interesting and problematic directions. So I expect you will come up with something new and interesting that we haven't thought of before. Hey, thanks, Phil. This has been fun.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Well, I could go on for a long time with Phil, and we'll have him back again sooner than the last interval between appearances. Because he's done some terrific work refuting a lot of the premises of income inequality that the left is obsessed with today. He also thinks, by the way, that cats are more likely than dogs to be communists, which is a prejudice I strongly agree with. But I hope if you do follow social media, I have linked to Phil's Twitter address, and also I put in a link to his new article on Marx that we talked about at the beginning. It is behind a paywall, but some of you may have access to it through academic portals and things of that kind. We'll be back on Saturday with another edition of the Three Whiskey Happy Hour. But for now, don't forget to milk the soft power dividend. Bye-bye, everybody.
Ricochet. Join the conversation.